Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Terry Wilson, and he'll be answering your most important questions on crappie fly fishing. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Terry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Terry Wilson about crappie fly fishing. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won national conservation awards for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers like you willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give back something to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Terry, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. And for our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Terry's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Terry and Roxanne's book, Crappie Fly Fishing, courtesy of Amato Books. You can find out more about the books that the Wilsons have written, as well as many other fly fishing books, at AmatoBooks.com. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something we talked about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and your location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Terry and Roxanne's book. Well, tonight our guest is Terry Wilson. Terry and his wife Roxanne have written over 200 articles for warm water species that have appeared in many national and regional magazines in the past 30 years. They are regular contributors to the Fly Fisher and staff writers for Outdoor Guide and Driftwood Outdoors. They are the authors of three other books, Bluegill Fly Fishing and Flies, Largemouth Bass Fly Fishing, Beyond the Basics, and Smallmouth Bass Fly Fishing, A Practical Guide. They are the creators of many warm water flies, including Bullies, Bluegill Spider. Terry and Roxanne are affiliated with Whiting, Reddington, Sage, and Rio. Terry is the president of the Tri-Lakes Fly Fishers, and both the Wilsons serve on the board of the Missouri Outdoor Communicators. Their newest flies can be seen at www.thebluegillpond.com. Well, Terry, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, good to have you, and adjust your volume up just a little bit there, and you should be good to go. Well, we had, as I told you before the show, I was pleasantly surprised by all the questions we had on crappies. I was kind of wondering how much their interest there would be since we'd never done a show on crappies, but obviously there's a lot of interest. And I'm sure you're going to tell us why there is tonight.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Crappie may be the most popular species, through all of the different avenues of fishing. And I think it's often overlooked by fly fishers, but I think there is great interest in it. So I hope we can turn some more people on to all the fun that crappie fly fishing really entails.
Yeah, you know, in reading your book, I realized how widespread it was. But why don't you tell us what the geographic range that we'd find crappie in, and also tell us, you know, why you think crappie is one of the most popular fish.
Well, it's first of all, the two separate questions are really very interrelated. I think that a lot of the popularity stems from the fact that they are readily available almost everywhere, from southern Canada to northern Mexico, and all states with the exception of Alaska. So, you know, it's just available. It's a species that is very, very friendly to spawn and very, very prolific, and consequently there's a lot of them. And I think that that probably has as much to do with their popularity as anything. As far as why use a fly rod, it's more fun, frankly. I think that the fly rod really gives you an advantage because of the soft springiness of the rod. A crappie's mouth is very soft and it's easy with a firm hook set to pull the fly free. And as a result, I think that a lot of people would really benefit from using a fly rod. In fact, crappie rods have kind of imitated that with their long, flexible rods. And consequently, I think that the longer you play a crappie, you know, and he's able to pull against the force of the rod, it makes the hole in the skin bigger and really increases his chance for escape. So we really have a tool that I think is adapted particularly well to crappie.
Now, is it strictly a North American fish then, with the exception of Hawaii?
Well, I really don't know if it's available in South America or not. I know that it is available in some really nice size in Mexico. Most of the warm water anglers that go down there, I suppose, fish for bass, but there are some exceptional lakes for crappie in Mexico, but there's also north of the border in southern Canada good also.
Yeah. Well, I'd assume they'd probably, you know, if people put their mind to it, they could move them down further south than South America.
Well, they're so adaptable. They can be
pretty
stocked.
Hardy.
They're very, very hardy. I had an email not long ago from a fellow in Japan who caught crappie in a pond close to his home within the city, within a large city in Japan. And I found that very interesting. So I would imagine that they've been stocked in a great many places, just as they have here in this country.
Right, right. There's actually, two different species of crappie?
Yes, there's a white crappie and also a black crappie. To further confuse the issue, they sometimes overlap a little bit and they will interbreed, which makes it difficult, I think, for the layman to identify exactly what they have. To me, they tend to look a little bit more like the black crappie when they intermingle like that. But they do occupy different types of water. The black crappie is very, very clear water oriented, not very adaptable to turbid water. They won't do nearly as well. They will exist there and can survive there, but they won't do as well as the white crappie. And that tends to make the black crappie pretty much of a northern species, and the white crappie tolerant of turbidity. And that makes it pretty popular as a southern species. And yet, that having been said, dominantly the black crappie is the species that's available in Florida. So that's a little bit of an oddity, but I think that it has to do probably with the clear water in Florida as opposed to some of the other big reservoirs along the south and mid-south.
Yeah, I suppose most of the canals in Florida are pretty clear.
Right.
Yeah, they don't have a lot of drainage and, you know, they don't have tributaries going into them and things like that to bring sediment and silt and that kind of thing. But, of course, I think in Florida, I think they have everything, every kind of fish you want to fish for.
Boy.
Maybe not northern pike or muskie, but
yeah,
salmon. But I'll tell you, it's kind of a fisherman's wonderland down there, isn't it?
It is. It certainly is. And I think that probably the crappie is overlooked as much in Florida as any place, really, because of all that availability that they have.
Yeah, well, there was a Skip Clement, who's very well known in the fly fishing world, particularly in more in the saltwater. He did write in, and I'm going to skip to that right away, because he said he did a story on, I guess, you and Roxanne in Fly Life magazine.
Yes, we've seen it.
Magazine, and he said he became enamored with the subject, and now much of his Florida fishing is done in the canals and lakes, with crappie and largemouth being a hoot for him on fly rods. So he bought both your books, and so there you go. You have a saltwater guy that you converted into a bass and crappie guy.
Well, that's a pretty good recommendation from a fellow like that. Yeah, we've seen his story, and surely thank him for that. He was very complimentary, and we appreciated it.
Yeah, well, great, great. So there are, we talked about water now and the differences in the water, what they prefer and so forth. So the temperature, I know you go into very specifics about temperature and spawning. We'll probably get to that a little later. But so between the two species, the black prefers colder water, but not necessarily. More has to do with the clear water than anything else.
I think that it does, yeah. It just so happens that most of the natural clear water in places like Wisconsin and Minnesota and New York State and so forth, all across the northern tier of states, that seems to be black crappie territory, mm-hmm. whereas the mid-south and south, very much white crappie, like I say, with the exception, of course, of Florida.
You know, will we find crappie in both still water and streams and rivers?
Yes. I think that they tend to do a little better and consequently maybe grow a little larger in still water, but it's just because life is easier there. They don't like to fight the current terribly well, although they're a little more current-oriented than a bluegill, for example, and most other panfish. So, yes, they will occupy both.
Okay. But their spawning activity is primarily in still water? Or does it happen in both places, too?
It happens in both places, but I think if you are looking at a population of river crappie, you're going to find places where the current breaks are greatest, where the brush build up, or there is a little inlet off of the main flow of the river where a more still water environment is available, that crappie will tend to spawn there and really spend quite a little bit of the year in that particular position.
It sounds like, from the way that you're talking, that's, if you want to go after crappie, that's not really where you want to be. It's in a river or stream. You want to be out in the still water and the lakes and ponds and so forth.
Well, I think that they're easier to locate probably there, but it depends very much on the river system. If you're looking at a rather large, slow-flowing river, that might be a real good place for a good population of crappie. I think probably the more vegetation that you'll find in a river, the more apt you are to find a good population of crappie as well.
Okay, okay. We've got some questions on, and we'll get into more detail when we talk about techniques and strategies later, about the seasons and where to look for them, because I think that's one of the big questions that people have about crappie is where are they? And they do move around quite a bit from my reading of your book. So we'll talk about that a little later. Yeah, let's talk about equipment for a few minutes. Tom in Eureka, Illinois, he asked, as well as Rick Takahashi in Fort Collins, Colorado, both asked about, rod weight, line, and so forth. So could you kind of go into what rod, length and weight that you recommend?
Yeah, I sure can. Most species, I believe, you're going to select the weight of the rod and the action of the rod in accordance with the size of the fly that you are throwing. But here with crappie, it depends very much on the location of the crappie because they can be very shallow in a pre-spawn situation, maybe even with their backs out of the water, in the extreme, to 22 feet deep over a 35-foot bottom. And so you need to select your rod, I think, with those parameters in mind. And obviously, in all of those situations, I would choose the lightest rod that I felt that I could handle the situation. with ideally maybe a 3-weight or a 4-weight. But quite often the crappie, especially after the spawn, are not in shallow water. And you need to be able to set the hook firmly enough. You can imagine from 22 feet of depth that setting the hook with a 3-weight is going to be real, real difficult. So I like to say that the choice of rod should be somewhere between a 3-weight and 7-weight, depending on not only the flies that you're using, but how deep they're located and the type of structure that you're fishing. If you're fishing a lot of brush, for example, you're going to have to choose something that will either break off the fly or will bring you through that tangled mess. But if you're fishing vegetation or you're fishing a rock pile, for example, you might choose a very different weapon.
So it sounds like you want as light a rod as possible, but a rod with some backbone in it.
Yes.
As well, especially in deeper water.
Yes.
So so you've got seasonal choices there, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, when you're out fishing, do you primarily fish from a boat, the float tube, the shore, or all of the above?
Yeah, all of the above, for sure.
Okay.
I think certainly one of my most favorite ways of fishing probably is in a float tube. It gets you right to the situation. And yet it's very, very comfortable and maneuverable, and you can cast at a piece of structure from many, many different angles. But here I have really the opportunity to fish everything from large reservoirs to small farm ponds. And so fishing from shore is something that we do quite often. We use float tubes at times on kind of a medium-sized water situation. We have a bass boat that we fish on the large reservoirs, and we also have a canoe. And so, just about any different way that you can fish. And I don't dislike any of them, I have to say. But maybe my preference might be that float tube.
Okay. Mike in Boiseville, not sure where that is. It's got MY there. That must be hopefully New York, I think.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, he says he bought, I guess, and there was a little corruption in the message he sent, but I think what he wrote was, I bought a $25 crappie rod at a local sports shop. So it looks and feels like a cheap 13-foot fly rod. I have no idea why it's so long and has fly rod-type guides on the rod. How is this a crappie rod, and why so long? And this this brings me to I was doing some training down in, I believe it was Missouri, and one of the guys that was working at the plant that I was training in, he was a professional crappie pro. I didn't even know they existed.
Absolutely.
I know there were bass pros out there, but crappie pros?
I guess so.
But he was explaining his situation on his boat, that on the front of his boat he had like 5 rods in a rack that were fanned out like your hand, and all fishing, I guess, at different depths. Is that what the kind of rod that he's talking about, or maybe you can explain?
I think that's exactly it. And the length of the rod, I think, is simply so it can reach a lot of different locations from shore, or if you're in a boat, to splay out in maybe a multi-rod display, I guess. But the reason he has fly rod guides on there is because even those crappie pros have recognized that there's a lot to be said for the fly rod. I have known several people that have fished with a fly rod but have a spinning rod attached to the fly rod, and that's their crappie outfit. And the reason is because of all of that flexibility of the rod enables you to get a hook set and not, pull the hook free. And so without looking at Mike's rod there, I think that that's what he has.
Those kind of rods aren't designed really for casting so much as just hanging out, right?
Absolutely. It's the old cane pole and bobber idea, I think.
Yeah, that's what I thought, because that's the way this guy described the way he fished. And I don't know, when you're a crappie pro, if you win by size and quantity both or what. but
Well, they have limits. We have some crappie tournaments here in our own area, actually. They win by total weight, but they'll have a limit, and so consequently the greater number of the bigger fish that you're catching is going to put you in the winner's column.
And that's, and it's permissible to have like five rods or something going at once, I guess.
Yeah, and of course I don't really know, I don't follow that circuit at all. I don't know if there's a limitation on it or not, but I do see guys out on the big reservoirs with those kinds of rigs.
Now, and I guess that's because of the schooling nature of crappie, being that they can move through a school.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
So the Steve in Cincinnati wrote in. He wanted to know about what you'd recommend for his 7-year-old grandson, whose first attempt at fly fishing, and, you know, who was finding it a little challenging to stay on task. Do you have any recommendations for kids? Because I know some of the first fish I ever caught on a fly rod were bluegill, and not so much crappie, but a lot of bluegills. So that's a good way to start out.
That's right. Well, Steve, thanks for sending that question in. It's a great question. I can tell you how I started my kids and grandkids, too, and that was with a fly rod tip-top section. And I attached a monofilament to the end, to the tip-top guide, and used a strike indicator, a small hook so that setting the hook would not be problematic, some small bit of live bait. And he mentions, I think, trying to keep his grandson focused on the task at hand. And I think that you're better off to just let the child, if he wants to go chase a butterfly or see if he can catch the tadpole in the end of the pond or whatever the situation might be, to just go ahead and do that. And as complimentary as you can be about catching the fish and how well he did, he's going to want to go with Grandpa again.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the warm water lakes and stuff where you can catch fish relatively easy, at least bluegills or something like that, I think is a great place to start them out. We did, by the way, for Steve's benefit too, we did a show with Fanny Krieger, and I know a lot of people know Fanny Krieger and know of her and her husband Mel, who passed away a couple of years ago. But Fanny, we did a show with Fanny on Tomorrow's Fly Fishers, and actually the whole show is about working with children and how to teach them about fly fishing. So that might be something, Steve, you might want to look in our archive for. It's called Tomorrow's Fly Fishers, Fanny Krieger. So that's a great show on just that specifically.
Had the pleasure of meeting Fanny and Mel years ago. And good. She would be a wonderful resource, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. I'm thinking, too, about something that I'm just getting ready to try, because when I got my rods, it was just turning into winter. But we did a show with Daniel Gagliardo on the Tenkara rods. And
right.
I'm thinking that Tenkara rods might be a transition rod from, like, where you were talking, you know, to a step up and then on to a full fly rig, you know, depending on the age of the kid.
Well, you're just exactly right, because the next step that I always take is to go ahead and piece the fly rod together and add monofilament to the end of it, and you can almost teach a roll cast even with monofilament line, but it shows them that they are using the rod and the flex of the rod to get it out a little bit farther.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the next challenge, I think.
Rick Takahashi, who's been on our show, we did a show with Rick on midges, Fort Collins, Colorado, he wrote in and asked about leaders and tippets and what you use in respect to mono versus fluorocarbon size and so forth. And you did already mention, you talked about the importance of terminal tackle and working around and through structures and weeds and so forth. Can you tell us how you rig up and if you change it up or how you change it up?
Well, I sure do change it up. Changed up a lot, really.
Very
often, I will use a regular 9-foot tapered leader down to, depending on water clarity, sunlight penetration, and some other factors, a 4X or 5X, and that might be pretty typical. If we're going to use some kind of sinking line, full sinking line, or an intermediate line, or very possibly a sink tip, then we'll shorten the leader down to maybe 3.5 to 4 feet even. And the reason for that is so that the fly doesn't bow back towards the surface and kind of lose the intent of getting all of that down to start with. But Rick, on the tippets and the mono versus the fluorocarbon, I think that fluorocarbon really is not a good choice if you're fishing in the brush. And of course, crappie are frequently in the brush, so I probably use that a great deal less than monofilament. On the other hand, if they are in open water and they are, you know, not near any kinds of structure, then I think that the fluorocarbon becomes a good choice. We like to say that crappie are a brush-oriented, structure-oriented fish. But having said that, and that certainly relates to their body type, a very flat, flexible body that enables them to maneuver in tight quarters around the brush and to feed effectively in that manner. And yet, having said that, they are a species that suspends over open water quite a great deal. But not true open water. By true open water, I mean out in the basin of a large lake where it would take a very muscular, powerful fish, and I'm thinking of striped bass, Chinook salmon, something of that nature. And certainly a crappie is not that type of fish at all. But the type of open water that they seek is confined open water. It might be in the mouth of a cove, and it might be 100 yards in each direction to the shore, and yet their lateral line enables them to pick up the vibrations off of that, and that gives them a comfort range. They feel comfortable in that environment. And so if you're having trouble locating crappie in the lake or pond or river that you're fishing, the next place to look for them is in that confined open water space. And in that situation, I think that fluorocarbon does become a very viable option.
Why do you shy away from fluorocarbon in the weeds and structures?
More brush than weeds, certainly, but
okay.
Because of its consistency, I think that you're going to break off an awful lot.
More so with fluorocarbon.
Yeah, okay. More so with fluorocarbon than with mono, where you've got a little bit of stretch.
Yeah, okay. Terry, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll start digging into food and flies and what crappie eat and what we can fool them with. So we'll be right back. Stay with us, folks. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. And there you can view the fishing products and guide services they offer in both Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit their website at www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Terry Wilson about crappie fly fishing. If you'd like to ask Terry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to ask your question. We'll be answering as many questions as possible tonight as they come in. And we've got a couple questions coming in, but we'll leave those for just a minute and put them on topic here. Actually, let's start out with, before we talk about flies, with what a crappie eat, because that's what it's all about, is trying to mimic whatever the natural foods are. So what do they prefer, and is it different food at different times in their life or different seasons?
I think that's exactly right, and it depends really on several things. I think it depends, first of all, on the crappie's size as to what they might eat, and also about the available prey. As a very adaptable species, crappie will utilize whatever is most available to them. And sometimes that changes season by season, And that really is the next variable, the time of the year. And I'll run through an example. Certainly for young of the year crappie, we're talking about plankton eaters primarily that graduate eventually into usually subaquatic insect life. I think that's something that they never get away from entirely, but as crappie grow, they certainly become meat-oriented, and they are really, I suppose, the bait that's synonymous with crappie are minnows, and I think you need to kind of match the hatch, if you will, for matching a minnow, whether you've got shad available or, you know, some other kind of minnow. And also the young of the year of all of the species that are within that environment. And they'll also, of course, eat crayfish, even snails, worms, leeches, whatever is available to them. But I think that by and large, for the ones that we want to catch, the larger members of the species, generally you're trying to target that minnow population.
Okay. Yeah, I remember fishing with my grandfather up in northern Wisconsin, up right on the border of the UP up there. And I remember when we went crappie fishing, what we did is we went down to the local bait shop and got a bucket full of minnows. And that's what you went crappie fishing with, you know.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, so I can hear what you're saying. By the way, I kind of skipped over one of the things I normally do, so I'm going to stop now and do that, is just ask about, you know, what's been happening in your fly fishing world. And I know one of the things was the completion of this book on crappie, right?
Well, that's right, yes. Well, there's been an awful lot of things happening in our fly fishing world, I must say. Finishing the book, which certainly was a labor of love. We were encouraged right after our bluegill book, actually, to write a crappie book, which surprised us, I think, as much as it surprised you, Roger. Gosh, there's that kind of interest in crappie. But obviously there was, and once we got started on that, it really took off. We also operate a website, thebluegillpond.com, and we have full feature articles and a tip page on there. All of the products are original flies. I think there's maybe 12, 15 flies, something like that, that we offer for sale, and our books on our website as well. And then there's also a cartoon section. My brother is a wildlife artist in central Iowa, and he does our illustrations for all of our books and also those cartoons. And people should keep in mind that all of the stupid things that he cartoons, I have been the model for that. I've done those things.
Like it or not, huh?
Like it or not, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, I know you have some funny stories in your book, but I was intrigued by the illustrations in there. I said, oh, those are pretty nice illustrations in there.
Yeah, so he does nice work. Yeah, that's him.
Well, good. Why don't you name drop again your website so people can keep track of you and find out more about.
Yeah, you bet. It's simply thebluegillpond.com.
Okay. Great.
We'd love to have folks visit.
Great. Well, Tim and Rika, Illinois, wrote in. He says, what flies do you use? And actually, we had several questions about flies and in different respects. And he wanted to know if you had pictures on your website of your flies that you've created, and I assume so, right?
Yes, sir. We sure do. Right.
Okay. Yeah. And he did give you a compliment. He says he loves your bluegill book and thanks you for sharing all your knowledge with everybody else. So let's start out with talking about, you know, the array of different flies that you might use and maybe their purposes.
All right. Well, Tim, thank you for the nice compliment and the question. I am going to refer to my own original flies because, obviously, that's what we use. But also I will talk about some others that are, you know, well-known patterns that you can substitute in there also that, you know, do an equally good job as far as that's concerned. One of the neat things about fly fishing for crappie that does not come along very often is the opportunity to catch them on the surface. Even though many, many years ago, when I was 12 years old, I caught my first crappie on a red popper. And, you know, for the longest time, Roger, I thought it was the color red that attracted that crappie because I had been, just the week before, catching bluegills in exactly that same spot. And I caught several crappie that day. And, of course, eventually I discovered that it wasn't the red popper at all, that those fish were in the shallows, in the pre-spawn, building nests, and I just happened to present something that irritated them and that they grabbed. But today I like to use our sponge spider because it lands on the water very softly. It has a red spot near the hook bend that I think serves as a target for about any game species. And so if they're in the shallows, that's a fun fly to use. We also have a fly that is a takeoff of our Bully's bluegill spider, and we call it simply Crappie Bully. And it is tied on a Mustad 3366 hook, which your listeners will recognize as a wide gap hook. And we tie it in any size from size 4 to smaller, size 10 probably. It's silver tinsel chenille on the body. It has a red chenille gill, and it has rubber legs, round rubber legs, that flex as it drops through the water column. And the reason that we came up with that is because there are so many times that you have a suspended crappie, one that might be just off of the flats, for example, that you can drop that down, you get a little bit of action to kind of mesmerize the crappie, and they will then strike because of the movement and the flash and that sort of thing. We also use a fly that we call a squirrel spin, and this has a small double-aught spinner blade across the back. It's made with quick descent dubbing, which offers a little weight, by the way, and then it's named squirrel spin because the wing is a squirrel tail, and if it's a red or fox squirrel, the body will be gold and the spinner will be gold. And if it's silver, then it'll be of a gray squirrel. And this is a real good fly to troll. Certainly can be cast as well. Now, having said that, there are a couple of very well-known conventional flies that serve pretty much the same purpose. In different weights, I would strongly recommend a Clouser minnow. I can talk color later, but also the standard woolly bugger, which we call the our version is the Ozark woolly bugger, certainly not one that we created at all, but we kind of adapted for our own purpose. So those are primarily the flies that we use, but you need to keep in mind that as an insect feeder, they are our nymph feeders as well. So your favorite nymph pattern, and we have one we call the North Fork nymph that we like especially well. And it's a very generic type of fly that is tied in the round so that if it tumbles in the current or whatever, it looks the same.
Yeah, it looks kind of like a pheasant tail, close to a pheasant tail.
That's right. In fact, it is a pheasant tail with a rabbit dubbing thorax.
Yeah. What interests me is these are all pretty small flies. You know, I was thinking, you know, when you're talking minnows and so forth, that I was expecting to see more streamers, that kind of thing. But we can talk more about that in a few minutes.
Well, you know, let me interject a quick story here. There's a guide, a crappie guide, up on our, what we think of as our home lake, Pomme de Terre Lake, who is from South Louisiana, a Cajun fellow. And he told me, I asked him about, you know, what he used to catch his truly big crappie. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, you know, you're going to find this hard to believe, but he said, I dress a number of crappie for my clients each year that have the size of shad in its stomach that is half of the body length of the crappie. and they are invariably folded in half, and the stomach is absolutely swollen with that one fish. And yet here they are, you know, trying to feed on something else. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was remarkable, because what he's saying is if you caught a 14-inch crappie, you're talking about a shad in its stomach 7 inches long.
Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems, you know, I've heard those stories, too, about, you know, like pike.
Where, right.
You know, and it never happened to me, but I've been with guides who said they've pulled in pike with the end of a, you know, like a 14, 15-inch pike in, you know, tail sticking out of the pike's mouth, and they still went after the, you know, the bait. And
yep.
Amazing. Yeah, what they, you know, I guess, you know, that's what you think about all day long is eating, and that's... So that's what you do.
I guess they're more like we than we are than maybe we'd like to think. Huh?
Yeah, I always, you know, people talk about, you know, kind of stress and viciousness of the world and so forth. And I said, all you have to do is go underwater. How'd you like to be a fish or a shrimp? I mean, especially in the salt water, where every day your whole goal is just to stay alive. Just for one more day, because somebody's trying to eat you, you know. I mean, what a life to live, you know.
That's right.
It's really not too pleasant.
The old guide pointed out that, you know, you're probably not going to catch many if you use a 7-inch streamer on crappie, but you may wind up catching the biggest crappie of your life. So, you know,
true.
I guess we all have to make choices.
Yeah. I remember my uncle fishing for muskie, and I swear he was using lures, you know, the length of my forearm for just that purpose, yeah, to get the biggest one he could get, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we need to take another quick break here, but we'll come back and talk more about flies here in just a minute. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or you can call Pudge directly at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Terry Wilson about crappie fly fishing. If you'd like to ask Terry a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use the Q&A text box to ask us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Got kind of an interesting message here, Terry, on the Internet that came in from Danny Rock. He's in LaGrange, Georgia, I believe. And he says, I've been looking forward to this program. Happy to say I tuned in late because I just finished cleaning a mess of crappie. Caught fly fishing this evening, wading shallow shoreline at West Point Lake, LaGrange, Georgia. They were hitting most anything. I'll look forward to your book. Great program. So it sounds like maybe spring has sprung, huh?
Well, it certainly has in Georgia. I'll tell you, maybe you and I ought to be, maybe we ought to be interviewing him, Roger.
Yeah, it sounds like he's doing pretty darn good.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, well, where I'm at, there's certainly, I just got 4 inches of snow last night, so spring isn't here yet.
Oh, my.
But down in Georgia, sounds like the fishing is good.
That's
great.
Right.
So, more about flies. There were questions from Lee in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, about colors. Are there particular colors? I noticed that one fly you mentioned looked like a rock star, kind of.
red
head and silver tinsel and white, you know, legs. Yeah, it was pretty
well,
colorful.
Lee, thanks. Thank you for that question. Yeah, I think, really, if you were to ask 10 different crappie fishermen what their favorite color was, I suspect that you might get 10 different answers. Having said that, I am awfully partial in the springtime when they are bedding and even on into post-spawn to silver and white. After that, it depends a lot on sunlight penetration and depth. not only in the color of fly, but also the depth at which the crappie will be located is very dependent on sunlight penetration. And I think that as you get below, 10 or 12 feet of depth, I think that the best choice is probably a dark fly or maybe a fluorescent fly. But those two dominate what we use in extremely deep water. In the interim, I like a chartreuse, at least partially chartreuse fly. It might be chartreuse over white. It might be yellow and chartreuse. We have some other fly fishers here locally that wear by chartreuse and black, and I think probably throughout the season, that might be a good choice for all different depths and maybe, you know, all different seasons of the year, possibly. But I think that there are an awful lot of good colors, and I think that color is very much dependent upon what the fish can see under those very changeable light conditions at that particular time. And I think that red is visible from maybe the greatest distance to fish in that environment. So I always like to incorporate just a little bit of red in the flies that I use also.
Now, when you're in the deeper water, you're going for that silhouette, basically, and not so
That's
much
right.
the color, right? Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
We did get another question from Rick Takahashi. He's asking about the style of streamers you use for crappie. And he asked about color, too, which you just talked about. And then he also asked about streamers, and he asked about jig patterns, weight and size. So do you actually use jigs in your fly fishing? Or do you use flies as jigs, kind of?
Yeah, I would call some of the flies that we use jig style flies, although I do not use the weighted head that is already attached to the hook. I might use a bead head, mm-hmm. and I might use wrapped lead under the body, but probably not a jig-style head. So certainly any marabou jig-style fly can be effective in the colors that we've already talked about, depending on season and depth and so forth. What was the other part of his question?
He was asking about style of streamers, which we were starting to talk about a little bit.
Yeah. Right. Well, Rick, I think that about any style of streamer, of course, I've already mentioned the Clouser and the Woolly Bugger as being two, but I really like using the old classic streamers that some of the main tires, Kerry Stevens and others, came up with many years ago. They are just as viable today as they were then. And some of them represent some very specific types of forage. But I use those a lot also.
Okay. And you had talked about this a little bit, about your first crappie being on a topwater, but Brian Adams in Bakersfield was asking about this. Now, did crappie ever take topwater flies? Obviously, yes.
Yes.
So he's asking about topwater dries and so forth. Is that more a spring when they're in the spawn in the shallows approach?
Yeah, maybe not exclusively, but okay. I think that the greatest percentage of crappie that you catch on the surface, which is going to be a small percentage of the total overall, I think, is going to be in the spring, yes. There are times when they will respond to an insect hatch and would be available if you can recognize what's happening and to match what they're, you know, pretty closely what they're feeding on. And there are times in the fall where they will come in quite shallow and feed very heavily, and I think a properly presented surface fly at that time would probably be effective also.
You know, we did get a question in on the internet from Bill up in Maine, and he was asking about, do you ever use dry flies? He says, here in Maine we catch crappie on small white wolves and atoms.
Yes, I think that somebody asked not long ago about the specific dry that I might use. And I don't think that crappie are nearly as selective as to genus and species as trout, but I think that they probably are very selective as to color, And I think that relates to visibility and also to size. And I think that they would tend to be more interested in a larger fly pattern than smaller. And I can certainly see a wolf pattern as being, you know, something very much akin to a small popper.
Do they, just lost my train of thought of what I was thinking of. Oh, I mean, I would think of them more as opportunistic feeders than match the hatch so much, right?
Yes, I think you're exactly right on that.
And when you, when you're talking about colors, you keep coming back to colors a lot. So do you change up a lot? I mean, if you think you're in the right area of where the crappie are you constantly changing to different colors? And how often would you do that?
You know, I think that that's probably the toughest call in warm water fly fishing. When do I change? How often do I change? Is the color that I'm using the maximum number that I'm catching, you know, over an extended period of time? Is that the best I can do? And that's really a hard call to make. But I try to match up the color that I select based on that sunlight penetration, you know, the extent of that. And I think that in general, I try to match light conditions, and let's define that as being in the extreme, very clear water and bright, unobstructed sunlight. Under those conditions, I would use a light-colored fly. And the reason is that it reflects the most light and consequently can be seen from the greatest distance and therefore has the opportunity to maybe draw the fish to the fly best. But in the darkest conditions, and let's define that as being kind of a muddy water, very low light conditions, either excessively cloudy or early and late in the day, then I would use a dark color. And you mentioned just a while back about the stark silhouette being the thing that is most visible to the fish. And remember that they're looking from a dark environment up into the light. And so if they see that dark silhouette, I think that that's the thing that is most visible to them at that particular time.
Great, great. So we've already got into some tactics here and some strategies, but let's dig deep into that. And Frank, and maybe you can kind of get into the different seasons now as we talk about this, because I know you're going to have different strategies for the different seasons. Yes. Frank in Colorado asked about how can they be located in small lakes at different times of the year. So I don't know how you want to approach this, Terry, but you want to kind of give us a more in-depth overview of the seasons and your approaches?
Sure. That's a very difficult question to answer because I don't know, you know, the type of lake or you know, anything about it and the structure or what's available there. But I think in general, during the spring of the year, we know that those crappie, when the temperature reaches the low 60s from 60 to 65, that they're going to be spawning sometime very soon. And so probably in the late 50s, we can assume that those fish are going to be in a pre-spawn attitude, so very, very vulnerable. Now, they're not feeding, per se, at that time of year, but they are very, very territorial. They are building their nest. They are trying to keep it clean. Anything that is nearby that presents a threat to them, they will attack. And obviously the only way they have of attacking is by grabbing it with their mouth. So I think that what we want to do during that time of year is to present something that does not have a big splashdown, something that has a little flash and some action to it. And we need to use a floating line, kind of a delicate leader, where we're not being, you know, we're not disturbing the fish a great deal. We're just presenting something that might be attractive. As they move deeper, let's move into the early summer, where they have moved out. If they have the availability of deep water, of course, that being a relative term, then they're going to usually be near structure. Now, that might be brush pile. It could be a downed tree. It might be a standing piece of timber. It could be a rock pile. But wherever it is that they are located, the chances are that they're going to be in a depth of, it's a very difficult thing to say, I guess, exact depth, but let's say, between 8 feet and 20 feet, just as an example. Most of the time, what your choices are very, very limited. If they are at 8 feet and above, you have a chance to troll, you have a chance to cast, if you can control the depth at which your line sinks on a full sink line or intermediate or sink tip, then you can control that first 8 feet. Beyond that, it becomes very, very difficult because eventually it becomes a vertical fishing operation. And when that's the case, we make one of two choices. We will either use a strike indicator with light flies, obviously, and mostly that is we're talking about imitating insects with a nymph or, whatever. And if it's something that is larger and we want to imitate a minnow, then we're going to use a conventional slip bobber. We actually keep, each of us, a spare spool that is nothing more than monofilament. And to that, we attach an appropriate tippet that might be 4X or 5X and the fly below that. And the weight of the fly usually is all that you need to cause the monofilament to strip through the slip bobber and to go to the depth where you suspect fish or where you know the fish are located. And that's the way we take care of fish that are in the summer depths, and also some of the winter fishing is done in that same manner.
Okay. Yeah, because you're so deep, you really can't maneuver down there.
No, and is that my preferred way to fish? No, I think we're all attracted to the beauty of the cast. And even though warm water casting is much more open loop type casting than it is with the tight loops that we admire so much in the casting videos, still we prefer to cast than to do any of the other methods, whether it's trolling or whether it's using a strike indicator or a slip bobber. But if you're going to catch the species during those times, that's the choice that you have to make.
Okay. So it sounds like you're using everything from floating to sink tip to intermediate to full sinking lines.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Who would have thought you'd have to have so many spools for crappie fishing?
Well, that's right.
Yeah. Well, you can always go back to the cane pole and the bobber, right? And and you just need one setup or something.
That's right.
Yeah. We got a couple of questions. They're kind of intertwined again. Jeff, this is on the internet. Jeff in Jefferson City, Missouri, down in your part of the country there, too.
Absolutely, yes.
He said, can you speak about techniques for finding the crappie when the spawn is not on? So if you can do that. And then also there was a question about using, without a depth fish finder, how do you find crappie? So those... That's from Kenneth in Atkins, Illinois, or Kenneth Atkins in Illinois. So if you could kind of address those, how do we go about that if you're not a fish finder kind of guy and just trying
well, if
to
you don't
get
have
all
a,
that trout?
If you don't, right. If you don't have a fish locator, I think that you have there are two things that you must do. And I place a great deal of importance on sunlight penetration. I've already mentioned that several times. But it has so much to do with the location of the crappie. They don't have eyelids. Their iris doesn't constrict like yours and mine. And so in order to be any kind of comfortable at all, or certainly to see your fly, they're going to have to be at a depth where that sunlight is manageable. And consequently, we can look at the day and look at the color of the water, and we can make a calculated guess as to the depth that they might be. And once we do that and we say, okay, I figure that with this strong sunlight and with this clear water, I'm figuring that those fish are at least 10 feet. Now, what is available to them at that? Well, certainly if I had a lake map, that would be an awfully good item. And one of the things that I always recommend is if you're fishing a lake or a body of water or a pond, for that matter, that does not have a map made specifically for it that you can purchase, make your own. And in time, you will get to know that lake and the depths of certain structural items where you can then begin to build a pattern for where fish will locate when they are at that particular depth. And the second thing that you can do, and this kind of maybe takes care of two problems at once, but one of the locational tools that you can use is trolling. By controlling the line that you are using, let's imagine that it's full sinking. Let's say that it's a fast sinking line at 6 inches per second, for example. You need to cast out, allow it to sink, and as you count that down, 1,001, 1,002, and so forth, you get it to the level that you want, and then you want to begin your trolling, whether by rowing or sculling or paddling or with an electronic trolling motor, whatever it might be, at the speed that it will maintain that depth. And then when you are able to catch fish, when you have a hookup, you know the depth at which the fish are located and you can return there. I think that one of the things about crappie, especially after the spawn, is that they are a species that tends to isolate and look at, even stare down, their prospective meal and before they strike it. And so that is one of the things that kind of lends itself well to the strike indicator type of arrangement. But the good news is that while they may be difficult to locate, particularly in a body of water that you don't know very well, once you find them, you are going to find many. And even better news is if you catch a good one, a large one, the chances that they are suspended there or they're feeding there with their own year class, which means generally the same size, is pretty good.
So how many fish would you say generally are in a school?
Oh, that's really a difficult question.
15?
Much more than five, certainly. But depends on the size of the water, whether that is the primary species or whether it's very much a secondary species. But it would not be uncommon to find 100 and more located in the same area. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So there was a question, and this kind of goes back to, well, before I move on to that, I guess my comment on what you just said, it sounds like a perfect opportunity to do some journaling if you're working a piece of water that you're going to be fishing all the time, you know, noting time of year, you know, whether it's clear skies, overcast, semi-overcast, where you were on the lake and on that map you were talking about, as well as, you know, the depth that you actually caught them in and keep track of that stuff.
Right. Well, that's very interesting that you bring that up, because Roxanne and I have kept a fishing diary since 1968. And ironically, what we intended to do was to keep it for a year. And we thought we would have everything pretty well patterned out and we could return to the successful situation time after time. Well, here we are nearly 50 years later, and we're still keeping a journal entry of every trip that we make. And the reason for it is that we have learned a great deal, and we have improved our fishing, but we also recognize we've just scratched the surface.
Oh, gosh. That's fishing for you, yeah.
That's fishing. That's why we do it, I guess.
Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, friends of mine are saying, how many shows have you done? I said, probably over 170 shows on fly fishing. And, they go, there's that much to talk about? I go, we barely scratched the surface.
That's right.
Yeah. And then you talk to two different or three different people about the same fish or situation, then you've got a whole other, you know, new story. So,
oh, absolutely.
It's always fun. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, a ton more questions left and so little time here, so let's see how many we can run through here. And I think you kind of addressed some of these already. Best way to get it to depth and still be realistic, I think you talked about that with your line selection and potentially trolling. I think we've kind of talked about that. Winter crappie fishing, when they're down deep, I think you've pretty much covered that one as well with techniques there.
Let me inject something on that wintertime, if you don't mind.
Yeah. Go ahead.
On big reservoirs where there is a lot of standing timber still in the water, it's remarkable how many times I find crappie kind of in the upper reaches of the branches during midwinter. And that's most particularly true if you are looking at a high sky, sunlight penetration. It's almost like, I mean, I'm making an assumption here, I certainly don't know, but it seems like the crappie are moving into that shallow situation because they are attracted by the warmth of the sun, the penetration of the sun. And it's not unusual here for me to find crappie at, say, 6 feet in the middle of the winter on a very sunny, warm day.
Well, that's the next question I was going to go to is this Randy in Tennessee, and one of parts of a longer question here was dealing with water temperature, and he's asking if that makes the crappie prefer a certain depth. And we know with other fish like trout and so forth that many times water temperature dictates where they are.
Yeah.
Pretty strictly. Is that something you can use? I mean, I know a lot of guys have a thermometer that they drop in off their float tube, you know, to see what the temperature is at certain depths for trout fishing. Is that something you do with crappie fishing?
Yes, and it certainly is a factor. I think that it's a factor in combination with other things like sunlight penetration, like the coloration of the water, and certainly the availability of food. But all of those things mixed together, remembering that the comfort level, if we're talking strictly about temperature, the comfort level for a crappie is about 65. So that being the case, you're often not going to find that kind of water temperature in middle July in the Mid-South, as an example. You know, it's going to be warmer than that. But remember, we're talking about a very adaptable species here, and they'll adapt to that circumstance. But I think a lot of people make the mistake of taking the water temperature on the surface, or certainly in the first maybe even 2 or 3 feet. But I think the water temperature is only a factor if it's taken at the depth that you expect or find fish. So it's important that we're able to get a temperature reading at 12 feet. It's important that we get that temperature reading at 4 feet in the shallows of a protected cove at that particular time of year, whatever the circumstance might be. But I think it has to be at the appropriate depth.
So with that, well, I mean, I'm just trying to think again of the thermometer over the float tube kind of approach. If you did find the water was 65 degrees at 8 feet, would that be a good place to start, given all the other factors?
I mean, absolutely, good place to start. That's exactly the way it should be phrased. That's the good place to start.
So if you were going to take the top three things in order, we've got a lake out here and we're looking at it and we're going to go try to find some crappie today. What are the top three things in the order that you would analyze to get a starting point out there?
Number one, sunlight penetration. Number two, availability of food. Number three, water temperature.
Sun penetration, availability of food, and temperature. Now,
yep.
One thing you didn't say here, but I know this is kind of integrated into this, is the structure.
Yeah, that's right.
That's where the food is, basically.
Yeah, you're right. I think, I couldn't prove this, but I believe that when the crappie are suspended in those confined open water areas that we talked about earlier. I believe that they are feeding on insect, even minute insect life that is being drifted to them with the current. And I've certainly been much more successful with insect imitations in that circumstance than anything else, than with a minnow imitator, for example.
Mm-hmm. I know there's a ton of questions here we still haven't got to, but I think a lot of them we addressed in one way or another with your other answers. But one here, just when you said minute insect, there was a question here from Wayne in Maryland, and he says, have you ever experienced crappie feeding on emerging midges, and did you find a successful pattern that they would take?
Yes, actually I have, Wayne. Thanks for that question. It's not a circumstance that I find very often, and frankly, most of the time when I find them taking midges, they are smaller crappie, not necessarily young of the year, but maybe second-year fish. Certainly not, you know, a hand-sized fish of any description. And I didn't really find that pattern was really very much of a problem. And I have used standard dries in a size, 10, for example, 10 or 12. I've also even used a small popper in, for example, 10 or 12, and been successful in that circumstance if they're coming up and feeding on the surface. But it's a circumstance that I don't see very often, and I'm not sure if there is I haven't encountered that enough to really establish the parameters of why I theorize that they're there even.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. Two more final questions, and then we got to call it quits here. But these interested me when I was reading your book. Talk just, and this have to be brief, but talk about hook set with a crappie and also the best way to land and handle a crappie. And let's assume, well, catch and release if you're going to land and handle it, you know, what's the proper way for their survival.
Right. Well, as you've seen, Roger, brevity is kind of a problem for me. But, yeah, I think we can address that fairly quickly. The standard lifting of the fly rod and holding on to the fly line, pulling down on that slightly, is usually a pretty good hook set for crappie. You'd like to hook them in the upper lip, if at all possible. Have I encountered them when it seems like I'm missing them, and go to a strip set and then, you know, have hookups? Certainly that is the case, but I would say lifting the rod is far and away the most popular way and the most useful way to set the hook. You need to make that lift kind of slow and steady as opposed to jerking it, because we've talked about that soft mouth and tearing that membrane thin lip on the crappie, but usually lifting the rod steadily will do the trick. As far as landing them is concerned, there's an awful lot of people that you see, whether they're spin fishing, bait fishing, whatever they're doing, that will simply lift the crappie out of the water and swing them into the boat or onto the shore or wherever they might be. You're going to lose fish doing that. Far and away, the easiest way to land them is with a landing net. And if you've got one that is long-handled and you're fishing out of a boat, better yet, you're going to miss far fewer, and you're certainly going to damage fewer fish, I think, in the process of releasing them. And, you know, I'm frequently asked, by the way, should I be fishing for crappie during the spawn? They're so prolific, I don't really see that as a problem. Our policy here is that if we catch a female that's ripe with eggs, we do put her back. But all the male crappie and those that are spawned out, if you want to keep a mess of fish, I'm told that it's a delicious species. I can't really address that because I'm allergic to fish.
Oh, jeez. Well, it's all in the catching and the fishing then for you.
Absolutely. You
know, one question I have about, you know, the catching and releasing them is, and I see in your book that all over, you know, people are grabbing these as well as bass by their lips. And I just wonder about that. Is that something that's okay for a fish you're going to release, or would you rather not do that for a fish you're going to release?
Well, as long as it's not done in such a way that you're forcing the mouth into an unnatural position and maybe injuring the mouth in some way, I think that it's good. If you grasp right below the tongue with your thumb and put your index finger below the lip and you lift up sort of gently, it kind of paralyzes the fish for a little bit and it makes it easier to get the hook out and then to release him, and certainly can be done without harming the fish, I think.
Okay, great. Well, that's all we have time for tonight, and we still had a bunch more questions and some still coming in on the Internet. So quite popular the crappie has turned out to be, so that's very encouraging.
Great.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, anyone who would like to get on our website and ask those questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them for them.
Okay, so if you want to go to Jerry and Roxanne's website after the show, he's there to answer additional questions, which would be great. Thanks for that offer, Terry. Well, stick with us, folks. We're going to do a few giveaways here. The one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Dying Journal, and also Terry and Roxanne's book, Crappie Fly Fishing, courtesy of Amato Books at amatobooks.com. So stick with us just a couple more minutes, and we'll do those giveaways and see where we end up. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website at www.familyties.com. That's family, T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. And just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few prizes here. And the first one we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. Now, these are randomly drawn from our registration database. If you haven't registered yet, it's too late now, but do so next time, and so you have a chance at winning one of these great prizes we give away. So for that one-year membership to the Federation, and if you do want to find out more about Federation of Fly Fishers, you're not familiar with them, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. And our winner for that is Zach Funkhauser in Idaho. Zach Funkhauser in Idaho. So congratulations, Zach. If you've already got a membership, we'll get it extended. But if you don't, then you've got a great start on finding out more about the Federation. Okay, the next one is the one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which you can learn more about at amatobooks.com. And our winner there is Rob Drotto, and Rob is in Colorado. So congratulations, Rob, on winning that one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. I know you'll enjoy that and learn a lot from it. So let's give away that book here, Terry, of yours. And this is courtesy of Amato Books at amatobooks.com as well. And you know, I just got one of the last questions is, how do you cook them? And Terry can't answer that because he's allergic to fish.
You're right.
So let's ask the question to win Terry and Roxanne's book, Crappie Fly Fishing, their latest book in the series of books that they've written. And our question's going to be, Terry mentioned when we were talking about colors of flies and so forth, Terry mentioned that there was a color combination, two colors, that he thought worked in shallow water, deep water, and different times of the seasons, kind of an all-around color combination that he liked. What was that color combination that he mentioned? And so now, Terry, I sit here and wait to see about how fast our folks can type here and see if somebody's got the right answer to that, and I can win your book. And by the way, Terry's book, there is just a ton more information about crappie fishing that we didn't get to cover tonight. Very in-depth about the structures and how to fish the structures and the different seasons. So be sure if you don't win tonight, which is everybody but one person, you're going to want to go out and buy that. Okay, first answer is white and silver. Not what I was looking for, I don't think, is it, Terry?
No, that was a springtime color that I like particularly well.
Okay. Yeah, we were looking for that all-around color. Oh, I think maybe we got it. How about black and chartreuse?
That's it. Bingo.
That's it. So Dale Scala in Durham, North Carolina, you just won Terry Roxanne's book, Crappie Fly Fishing. So congratulations, Dale. And that's a new name. I haven't heard Dale before, so happy you're joining us and happy you won that. Congratulations. So
congratulations, Dale.
Yeah, now, Dale, you can either send me your mailing address either in the same text box you just answered the question in, or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com. But give me your mailing address so that we can get a motto to send that book out to you directly, and we'll be good to go on that. So congratulations to everybody, and Terry, thank you so much for spending your time with us and sharing all your knowledge over those many years of warm water fishing. We really appreciate it.
Well, Roger, if I can't be fishing, I'd rather talk about it, and so I've just had a ball and really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're welcome, and thanks for being with us. Everybody, if you're looking for something to learn, go to our archive on our show, on our website, and you'll find a link to the archive on the bottom of each page. Go there, you can search for anything, and in another few days, you'll be able to search for crappie on there. But crappie, particular pieces of water, types of fishing, you'll learn all kinds of things there. So explore that thoroughly, and I know you'll find and learn many things from our archive. Our next broadcast will be just a week from now, because we did have to postpone last week due to my illness. But next week, 1 week from today, we're doing our second show for April. It's going to be on April 17th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we're going to interview Rick Kusich, and our topic for the show will be Great Lakes Steelhead on the Fly. And Rick has fly fished for Great Lakes Steelhead for over 30 years, so listen in and take advantage of his in-depth knowledge on advanced strategies and techniques, two-handed rods, swinging flies, and new fly patterns that are all sure to get you hooked up on some trophy steelhead. So see you then for that show. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Housatonic Outfitters, and Women's Fly Fishing Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.